The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. For the last few weeks, I've been talking about the five faculties, which are five qualities that kind of support the skill of meditation. They are qualities that we need to unify our minds to come together so that we can meet the moment as it is. And these five qualities are confidence, also sometimes called faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And I've kind of done a little overview each week of these five faculties, and there's a lot of different ways to think about these five faculties, and one of them is that they need to be balanced in order to support the balanced movement of the mind in meditation. So, in the guided meditation, I was talking about a relaxed alertness, a relaxed attention. And that's a kind of a balance. There's relaxation and yet attentiveness. So with this, the five faculties, they are understood that there are pairs of balanced qualities. So the quality of confidence or faith needs to be balanced by wisdom. That if we are simply in a place of having faith that isn't grounded in some kind of wisdom, it can lead to a kind of a blind faith, a faith in something that isn't really rooted in a truth. And so those two qualities come into balance. And when they come into balance, there's the skill of meditation can more fruitfully begin to meet experience. Then the qualities of energy and concentration need to be balanced. And this is kind of the place of the exploration of the guided meditation, the relaxation of concentration that comes with concentration, the settling of the mind, the collecting of the mind, needs to be balanced with energy. If the mind is too relaxed, too settled, too concentrated, we'll just fall asleep. So there needs to be some energy to balance that. If the mind is more energetic than concentrated, we'll be restless. So these qualities need to come into balance for the mind to meet and settle with experience. The quality of mindfulness is said to be the balancer. Sometimes when Gil talks about this, he says there's no way to have too much mindfulness. Whereas some of the other qualities, we can't have too much concentration, we can't have too much energy because they're not in balance. The mindfulness is the thing, is the quality that supports the balancing of the other qualities. And so mindfulness is what I'd like to talk about today, this quality of mindfulness. So first of all, we often talk about mindfulness, but what is mindfulness? What actually is mindfulness? What do you understand when you think of the term mindfulness?
Being present.
Being present. Mm-hmm. That's an aspect of it. Anyone else? So knowing what's happening in the body at, essentially at the time it's happening. Mm-hmm.
Being the witness.
Being the witness.
And then caught up in all mental energy and thought.
Okay, so there's an aspect then of so being the witness, not being caught up in what's happening, so that it's an observation, kind of a maybe a step removed, or
just seeing it.
Just seeing it. Mm-hmm. So that the aspect, essentially, I'll put a word into your mouth, non-judgmental.
Right.
Joel?
It's noticing things moment to moment. Oh, I'm too energized now. Ah, my energy's starting to settle a little bit. Oh, now it's going. My body's, and it just moment to moment, kind of noticing things and not losing that kind of contact.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it includes the kind of knowing, the kind of the continuity.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's body, mind, I'm spacing out now, I'm thinking about this person who said this bad thing to me, noticing the anger I have about the guy who cut me off on the highway.
So knowing moment to moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have any? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Being aware that you are aware. Uh-huh.
Absorbing your consciousness.
So what do you mean by that?
Kind of just like taking in everything without giving any judgment to it and just kind of allowing each thought to come into you.
So I think you've touched on most of the pieces. I'll clarify just a little bit of some of the pieces. So there's the knowing what's happening, while it's happening. And that's kind of the being in the present, which you mentioned, so the knowing what's happening while it's happening. And that while it's happening part is really important, because I think we all have a familiarity perhaps with waking up and recognizing now that we are aware of awareness, you know, that awareness has come back, and that we remember what has been happening to us for the last 3 minutes. And yet we weren't particularly really aware of it while it was happening. So, one way to understand that is that the mind knows and perceives and feels all the time. And this quality of awareness is an added piece that reflects what is known, felt, perceived by the body, by the mind. So this mindfulness is kind of this reflecting quality. It reflects what's happening. It's just like a mirror in our minds that just actually reflects what is actually happening. And that quality of being aware that you are aware is a piece of that. It's that knowing what's happening while it's happening. The other crucial piece of it is around the non-judgmental nature of mindfulness. That I've used the mirror analogy a lot, but here again, it's a good one for seeing or understanding this non-judgmental quality. A mirror just reflects. The mirror doesn't care what it reflects. The capacity of the mirror to reflect is unchanged by what it reflects. And it's very like that with mindfulness. Mindfulness is not changed by what is happening to us in the present moment. And so that the capacity of mindfulness inherently is non-judgmental. It simply reflects. It doesn't judge, evaluate, condemn, want anything that it reflects. It just reflects. This quality of mindfulness just reflects. There are many other qualities that come up in our mind that do that, wanting, rejecting, all of that other, the getting caught side of things. So the aspect that Joel mentioned around the continuity, the moment to moment, that my understanding is that that's actually a manifestation of concentration. That the mindfulness in a moment is we can understand the mindfulness in a single moment, and that the quality of concentration is what allows us to meet this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. And so that's bringing those two together, the mindfulness and the concentration together. And we'll talk about concentration, well, maybe next week or maybe the following week, depending on how long it takes to talk about mindfulness. We'll see how far we get today. The other aspect about mindfulness that isn't particularly a definition of mindfulness, but is a piece that I like to point out, is that mindfulness is a very ordinary quality. It is something our minds do. It's a capacity that our minds have. It's not a special esoteric kind of thing. It's just the way our minds are set up, that we have this capacity to know what's happening while it's happening, that we have the capacity to be aware of awareness. So it's just a very ordinary quality. And we don't often recognize that quality because it is so ordinary. And I think it was a brilliant thing the Buddha did to point out, or to actually realize, oh wow, this capacity of the mind to reflect, this is a really important quality to cultivate. It's a really important quality to get to know, to get familiar with, and to strengthen so that it occurs more often. So why is it an important quality? Why is it helpful? I'll ask you again. Why is it helpful to be mindful? What does it do for us? Why did the Buddha point to this quality?
It allows you in a moment to make a skillful choice as opposed to a reaction.
It allows in a moment to make a skillful choice instead of a reaction. I'm repeating because we're not using the mics, so so that's a really to me, that's one of the main pieces, that when we are not mindful, our habits are kind of in charge. Our habits are the patterns, the ways that we have been conditioned are just kind of, it's like we're on autopilot. And the habits and patterns actually make our choices for us. So if we have been, if we have a habit of anger or a habit of wanting, these, when we're not mindful, these habits are kind of how we operate. When we bring mindfulness to our experience, we can begin to see that choices are being made. And when we're not so mindful, we're actually not aware that choices are being made. Actually, choices are being made all the time, so frequently. And the bringing of mindfulness in begins to reveal to us all of these times that choices are happening. You know, even a simple choice of what to have for a meal, or where to sit in a room. You know, let's take where to sit in a room. That's actually kind of an interesting one if I think about it. You know, if you're not mindful, then you're probably going to gravitate to perhaps wherever it was the teacher put you in a room in first grade. You know, that's what happened to me. I had bad eyes and I was very short. The teacher always put me in the front row. And that's where I go. I go to the front row. You know, others may more gravitate to the back. So, you know, this choice, you know, we don't really think about it. We kind of operate based on this feeling. What feels most comfortable, you know, and where we've been a lot is what feels comfortable. So when we are mindful, we can begin to see that these choices are being made out of habit. And we can begin to choose rather out of being conscious, to make conscious choices, to recognize when our choices are coming out of habit, perhaps reactivity. If something is unpleasant, we often immediately react, trying to get rid of it, trying to push it away, or to get ourselves out of the environment. If something's pleasant, we tend to be gravitating towards it, wanting it, wanting to keep it, hold on to it. So this is a kind of a reactivity that operates in our lives all the time. And with mindfulness, we can begin to choose, do I want to act out of these patterns and habits? We begin to actually see these moments of choice and are able to sometimes, not always, even sometimes when we are mindful, the habits and patterns have so much momentum that all we get to do is ride the wave of watching ourselves make that choice and get to see the consequences. And that's not a problem, because we can be aware of the consequences. We can be mindful of the consequences also. And this supports us in the cultivation of mindfulness, and also in the learning about how certain choices lead us into suffering. When we deeply, deeply learn through the practice of mindfulness what choices cause us suffering, through seeing the choice get made and then landing in the anger and the aversion or the wanting and the greed, and feeling the consequences of being in that space, the mind starts to let go of those choices slowly over time. It starts to let go of those choices. So we become more responsive to the present moment instead of reactive to the present moment. This piece is it's important to understand that when we become mindful of our choices, it doesn't mean that we don't make choices. It doesn't mean that we just sit back and kind of watch things happening around us. The movement is towards choosing skillfully as opposed to choosing unskillfully. Our unskillful choices tend to be motivated out of greed, aversion, delusion. Skillful choices out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. So there's a kind of a way that I've seen in my own practice. You know, these habitual choices that that just are the natural consequences of our conditioning. Sometimes it feels like they're kind of, these choices are coming out of our subconscious or our deeper levels of consciousness. Kind of that story about, you know, sitting where your teacher put you in the first grade. You know, that's just so deeply ingrained that it doesn't seem like it's really a choice. It's just coming out of such a deep place that it feels like it's not possible to see where that's coming from. It feels like it's coming out of the subconscious. So in my understanding and my practice, I have seen kind of this lowering of the horizon of the subconscious in a way. You know, it's like we typically are kind of operating where we're not really seeing much of what's happening under the covers. And mindfulness begins to pull back that covers, or it lowers the horizon of what might be called the subconscious, allowing us to see where some of these choices are coming from. It's the mindfulness plus the continuity, actually, plus the concentration that allows that lowering of the horizon of the subconscious. I've actually come to feel that there's not actually a subconscious. I mean, there is a subconscious in that there are things that we can't normally see, but that it is that there's a hard wall there. I don't believe that. You know, that I think it's amazing what the mind can see, and I think pretty much everything is accessible to the mind that has mindfulness and concentration together. We can deeply see into how our patterns come to be. So this is the power of mindfulness. It's truly a very powerful quality of mind that typically the way we use is, I mean, mindfulness actually happens to us a lot. It happens to us pretty much all day long, you know, in split seconds. Well, we don't exactly ignore it, but we kind of jump onto the thing we've noticed and then do something with it. So we don't notice the mindfulness itself. We notice the thing that we've become mindful of. And then we start reacting. It's a pleasant thing. Oh, let me get some of that. I want more of that. It's an unpleasant thing. Oh, how can I get rid of that? Oh, I need to get out of here. So we, as soon as we notice something in the present moment, I mean, we couldn't get through our day without being aware in the moment of what's happening while it's happening. We couldn't get through our day without that quality. This is where it comes back to that really ordinariness of the quality. But beginning to turn towards the recognition, oh, this is mindfulness. Mindfulness has happened. That we don't do. It has just slipped right by us. So, you know, through your day, actually learning to recognize mindfulness returning. Because it happens so much. You know, you see, you walk into the kitchen and you see a dirty glass. Oh, I forgot to wash the glass. In a split second, mindfulness has returned and then gotten lost. We saw the glass, we knew it was there, and then, oh, it's time to wash the glass. Now, it's certainly time to wash the glass, but we can also, in that moment, recognize mindfulness. Mindfulness has returned. So getting familiar with what it feels like to be mindful is a great support for beginning to recognize these moments when they happen throughout our day. You know, you're reaching for something, and oh, you notice you're reaching. Mindfulness has returned. And in that returning of mindfulness, there can kind of be, you know, there's a wave or a momentum that carries if you recognize that mindfulness has actually happened. And you can then just, you know, for a few moments, ride that wave of knowing, of being aware of what's happening. Instead of getting lost in washing the glass, we can be aware of washing the glass. Now, this is a pretty mundane example because, you know, there may be a little bit of greed or aversion around the wanting to wash the glass. But, you know, it's a pretty small thing. But in the mindfulness, when the mindfulness is there, we could actually notice or see whether there's an immediate sense of, oh, I hate it when my partner leaves dishes out on the counter. Or can we simply engage with that activity with just being aware? And noticing what comes up, noticing our reactivity instead of responding, instead of reacting to it, just noticing it. Let's see. So mindfulness is an extremely powerful quality of mind. And as I said, it's an ordinary quality, so it just happens to us. And one understanding, and the way the Buddha talked about mindfulness, is that it needs to be paired with wisdom. That it's not enough just to simply know that what is happening in the present moment, while it's happening. I mean, let's take an example of anger. You know, that it's possible to know that you're angry while you're angry. I mean, and still be really caught in the anger. That, you know, if you see somebody that's angry and then, you know, you may not want to do this with somebody you don't know, but, you know, and ask them, do you know that you're angry? Well, of course I know I'm angry. I mean, what kind of a question is that? Of course I know that I'm angry. So the mindfulness alone, just that knowing that we're angry while we're angry, isn't quite enough. Because that awareness can simply be caught up with self-justification, with self-righteousness, that actually serves to fuel the anger. So the just to know what's happening in the present moment while it's happening isn't quite enough. We also need to bring in some understanding that how we are paying attention to this thing is important. So if we're paying attention to that anger with the understanding that I have the right to be angry, that it's justified, it's not going to head us towards freedom from anger, for freedom from that suffering of the anger. So we need to have an understanding. The wisdom piece that comes in is basically the understanding of what is suffering. There's actually two parts to the wisdom that needs to join with the mindfulness. There's the understanding of what is suffering and what causes suffering. So anger is actually suffering. If you turn towards it and feel it in your mind and body, it's burning. Wanting is suffering. If you turn towards the wanting in the present moment, as opposed to being focused on the thing that you want, it feels like you're toppling forward. It feels unsatisfied. This is inherently a feeling of things are not right because I don't have the thing that I want. So again, it's understanding what is suffering is a piece of the wisdom that comes in to support the mindfulness moving us in the direction of happiness. Instead of struggle and suffering, dissatisfaction, unease. So that's one piece of the wisdom, the understanding what is suffering, or this is suffering. So if in looking at anger, you clearly recognize, oh, this state is suffering, this state is painful, is creating pain and harm to myself and possibly to others. Understanding that, that's the turning of the mindfulness towards the experience rather than being caught by the experience. So it's the wisdom piece of the mindfulness comes in the how we pay attention, how we are mindful, as opposed to what we are mindful of. It's way more important to be aware of how we are mindful than to be aware of what we are mindful of. We can be mindful of anything in this non-judgmental, non-reactive way. And so in the practice, in the practice of mindfulness, checking in from time to time, how are we paying attention? Is there an agenda of wanting something to happen? Is there an agenda of wanting to get rid of something? Now, not to make a problem out of those, it's those agendas will send us off towards in the direction of dissatisfaction, but only when they are not seen. Again, it's that lowering of the horizon. You know, often these motivations, these agendas in our back of our mind, the how we're paying attention, is kind of not so obvious to us. But we can simply turn and ask the question, how am I paying attention? What's my relationship to what is happening? Do I want something to happen? Do I want to get rid of something? As soon as that pattern of agenda becomes, we become aware of that, as soon as that becomes what is reflected by the mirror of mindfulness, that's just the next thing that we're paying attention to. And we can observe that spin, that we can observe that agenda with a mind that is non-judgmental and non-reactive. So two key elements of this wisdom, one being the recognizing what is suffering, the other being a beginning to understand how things are put together and cause and effect. Things don't happen randomly. Every experience that we have is put together based on conditions that have come together from the past, things that are happening now. And so everything that we experience is a product of causes and conditions. Conditions, by conditions I generally mean perhaps things that have happened in the past, so historical conditioning that our minds have been through, where our teacher put us in the schoolroom, how our parents behaved with us, ways we interacted with other people all through our lives. There's been conditioning. So that's part of the conditions. Another part of conditions is just the kind of outer conditions of the world, whether it's a sunny day or a gray day, whether the person we're talking to is happy or sad. These are all conditions that come together to make our experience of the moment. The causes, I think of the causes as being more kind of in the moment, how we respond to an experience causes our next experience. It's an input. The way we respond in this moment is a direct cause to how we respond, how we meet the next moment, and what our the experience of our next moment is. So beginning to see how suffering comes to be, how our experience comes to be, when we, it was kind of like beginning to understand how do our habits and patterns come to be. Yeah. Why don't you use the mic? And you need to turn it on, I think.
Can you get a feel for all this by the way you, like, sensations in your body? Like, if you're caught up in something, can you feel that? Like a tightness or a rigidity or
yes.
Restlessness or something?
Yes, yes. You can feel this. The kind of beginning exploration is around turning to just what is in the present moment. You know, one of my ways of talking about this is that in terms of wanting to understand causes, we typically think about or try to think about, why did this happen to me? So we move into our thoughts. We start reflecting, why did this happen to me? And we may go back to conditions from our childhood or, you know, various other conditions or, you know, well, why did this happen to me? Well, it happened because that person did that thing. So we bring it into our minds and typically go out into the world to decide or to determine, to assign blame. You know, why did this happen? Because of that and that and that. The practice of mindfulness is asking us to look at what are the causes or what are the reasons why in this moment this mind is responding in this way. And so the exploration of this has to do with just noticing what is happening right here and right now. And I think I mentioned this last time, something like this, that if you just notice what is happening right here and now, you will start to see how a thought leads to, or a sight, something we see leads to a memory, leads to a reaction. You can see that happening right in this moment. How seeing an apple just moves right into anger because of some memory that has intervened in a reaction to that memory. So we can see in the present moment the why of the present moment by looking at what is happening. And so that's that exploration you were talking about, just turning towards our experience moment to moment, as someone mentioned earlier, just meeting what is happening, what is happening, what is happening, what is happening. As we just meet what is happening over and over again, the mind gets the patterns of the why. It puts together the patterns of why this habitual pattern of anger comes up. It just starts to put it together. And at that point, we don't have to actually do anything to understand the why. We just understand it based on seeing the what. Yeah, Victor?
How much do you have to rein in the tendency, and maybe just a Western thing, to look into the why, as opposed to just seeing what's coming up, your mind just doing the pattern matching that it does? Because my background and whatever habits are to go, I wonder why, ponder, reflect.
I think the need to rein in depends on, it's probably dependent on the person. I, like you, had a very strong analytical habit, analyzing. I kept noting, analyzing is happening. So you don't so much have to rein it in as you have to note it as a process. Analyzing is happening. And so that's what's happening. That's what your mind is doing. Can you recognize it as opposed to following that thread? And, you know, it's helpful to really rein it in, or not so much rein it in, but really see it as a pattern that you're, this is a pattern of your mind. You're recognizing it as a pattern. Yeah, it's a really seductive pattern.
it's very slippery, and it's satisfying because when you see, I mean, a lot of times the pattern will become apparent. It's like, oh, a gift. But in other times, you'll work to see the pattern, so, and you will see the pattern, and so you get rewarded by seeing the pattern, so you want to see the pattern again.
Yeah. But I'd like to suggest it's probable that if you're seeing a pattern through that thought process, you're not actually experiencing the formation of that pattern. It's a reflection of what happened. It's like that looking at, how did I say this a few minutes? Oh, when I said, you know, we can remember something that has happened, and that's different from seeing it happening in the present moment. That's the way that reflective practice works. We think back and we see, oh, this is what happened in the last 5 seconds, and that's how I got here. But you're not actually seeing it happen here and now, which is where the freedom comes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get, it is a kind of an intellectual understanding through seeing it retrospectively. And that is seductive. It's kind of like there's a wanting because we get that reward of, oh, I understand now. It's like, oh, I have control over this now. But no, you find actually it happens still again.
Well, I think that's so slippery because I think that perpetuates the delusion. because you're still in, you're still the goldfish in the water, just not necessarily seeing the water. You're just, you're, I don't know how to explain it, but you actually explain it.
Thanks. Yeah, over here with the mic.
As you were speaking, it occurred to me...
Is that on? Is
that on? That when I hear you say the word mind, I see it as the noun, as the part of the brain that handles cognitive thoughts. And it occurred to me that it's also a verb. And we don't use this verb much in English. The only examples I can think of are mind your own business and perhaps mind your manners. But the Quakers use it somewhat in the sense, tend your flock.
Uh-huh.
But it's a verb, and it's an active verb.
It is an active verb. The mind is not a thing. There's not. I mean, a kind of a misunderstanding. We think we can find the mind, and sometimes that's a very sticky place that we attach a sense of self to. You know, the sense of being something that is the thing that knows. You know, I'm the one who knows, I'm the one who controls. And that is, it's just a process. So you're absolutely right. The mind is a verb. It is a process. It's not a thing. And there's no way to actually pin it down. It's just this, it's part of this flow that I mentioned in the guided meditation, the stream. The thing that sees the stream is just the stream, too. There's no distinction.
So it's really no more a thing than eat or run or sleep. When I know that I eat, I don't then construct this thing that is what eats. But with mind, I do that.
Yes.
It's odd.
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah. It's a powerful habit because there is this feeling. And, you know, it's interesting to reflect on where it comes from. It's like, you know, this feeling that I'm here. You know, it just feels that way. And so we attach that feeling to something. You know, since it feels like there's such a continuity of experience, there must be something there that is continuous. But it's an illusion.
It seems like to me that implicit in what you've been saying about mindfulness is a letting go of objectives or goals, including possibly the objective of being mindful.
I'll mention. Do you have more?
But well, just what I want. No, I don't. I wanted you to comment on that.
Okay. I'm happy to comment on that. So this is a process. It is true, in fact, that it is a process of letting go, and that we have to let go pretty much everything, including the desire to be mindful. At some point, we have to let go of that. And there's an analogy that the Buddha used about crossing this, what he calls the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion. And that in order to cross the flood, we need to, he uses an analogy of a raft. And in this analogy, he talks about, you know, gathering sticks and mud and, you know, things that are just around to create this raft so that we can cross that flood. And there's a couple of pieces about this analogy. One is that the analogy is using bits of mud and stones and sticks and maybe not stones, sticks and, logs that are just around. They're kind of just the ordinary things of life that we put together. And the putting together part, the building, the raft part, is using these five faculties, using confidence, using energy, using mindfulness, using concentration, using wisdom. We need to use these qualities to build this raft and to navigate that flood. The other interesting piece about this analogy is that we have to actually navigate that flood. We have to float on the top of greed, aversion, and delusion to cross it. We can't just somehow magically transcend it. We actually have to meet it with this raft of our everyday experience plus these qualities that support us floating on the stream instead of being swept away by it. So the path kind of leads us this way. We need to gather our experience, learn how to be mindful of it, learn how to be continuous, understand the wisdom that points us in the direction of letting go. And yet, while we're in the midst of that stream, we can't let go of the raft, or we'll drown. So there can be a skillful holding too. We have to have some discernment about when to let go. And so the final part of this analogy that the Buddha uses is that coming to the other side of the stream, the flood, coming to the other side of the flood, you hit dry ground, and you have this raft with you, the raft that's helped you cross this greed, aversion, and delusion. And he says, tell me, would somebody who picks up that raft and carries it around on his head on dry ground be doing what should be done with that raft? No. What you do with that raft is you leave it sitting there or you push it back into the stream. You let it go. And the final statement he makes is, so we should let go of even wholesome states of mind. How much more so even unwholesome states. But it's a staged thing. We have to use the wholesome states to help us let go of the unwholesome. Mindfulness supports our seeing. The mindfulness and wisdom together supports our seeing when we're caught by the unwholesome and picking up the wholesome to use it. At some point, if we get to that other side where there is no more greed, aversion, and delusion, there's no need to pick up mindfulness anymore. Greed, aversion, and delusion have fallen away. Mindfulness is naturally there.
But in that analogy, which is a lovely one, I like that, it's not clear that the goal, even before we let go of the five faculties, that the goal is to get to the other side. It may be to survive the flood.
The analogy is pointing to the point being getting to the other side. So I think that is actually even explicit in the analogy. How do you get across the flood? There can be, I suppose, a sense of riding out a flood. And that certainly happens to us in our day-to-day lives, that we have times where the waters rise and recede and rise and recede. And we need to be... And I certainly find in my own experience, when there is a lot of suffering, these qualities are much more naturally there. It's like I don't almost even have to call them up. It's just like when suffering arises, it's like, oh, there's suffering. And so, the raft is kind of there with me as the floodwaters rise. And then they recede, and I don't need to try so hard. It's just not like more like just kind of in the day-to-day flow of experience. It's not so much an energetic engagement as it might be when the floodwaters rise. But the analogy talks about crossing that flood, and that The other side is essentially the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. And that is the direction that this practice heads. And, you know, the thing that I really find amazing is that actually mindfulness joined with wisdom, you know, with, and it doesn't have to be a lot of wisdom. I mean, we hear that term wisdom and we, like, you know, blow it up into some, like, huge thing, you know, like, oh, how do I get this wisdom thing? The Buddha's wisdom, the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths, is really, really potent. It takes the smallest little bit of that wisdom to really shift our minds, you know? I think I've told the story kind of like this before, but in my first few months of practice, I was really observing anger. And about all I knew in terms of wisdom was, well, it's a good idea to try observing your anger instead of acting on it. That's a little bit of wisdom. And that's what I was trying to do, was just turn towards the anger, just be with it. And at some point, through this process over several months of watching the anger, at some point, I saw how the causes and conditions came together in the moment to form that anger. And I saw the choice that the mind could make to choose anger or not. And in seeing that, the mind chose not anger. Not something I did. The mind actually did it. It wasn't a conscious choice. It wasn't I'm not going to go there, or I have to let that go. It was like the letting go of a hand that's touching a hot pot on a stove. Just an automatic, I know where that leads. That's really unpleasant if I go there. So that all I had been doing for those months was just trying to be mindful of the anger when it arose and not acting on it. So the mindfulness was just meeting the anger, and the wisdom was try to not act on it. And in that moment of seeing that choice and seeing the anger fall away, it was a deep recognition of the truth of how my own mind constructed the anger. That I was no longer, I didn't have to be at the mercy of all of the conditions in the world, that there was some capacity of my mind to see choice and to not choose what made me suffer. So when I say mindfulness and wisdom together, it just needs to be, you know, a little bit of wisdom. We don't have to try to, you know, accumulate a lot of wisdom before we start trying to be mindful. It can just be this, just try to meet experience without reactivity. That bit of mindfulness and wisdom together is very powerful. And if we just follow that in our stream of our experience, it will head us across the flood. It's not going to happen like that, but it will head us in that direction. So I think it's time to stop now. So thank you all for your attention and your great questions. And I'm debating whether would you like me to talk a little bit more about mindfulness next week? I had some more things that I had in my notes. So I'll continue this next week a little bit. Thank you.